This show was previously broadcast live on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com.
Welcome to Expanding Mind, another of a weekly series of exploring the culture of consciousness. I'm your host, Eric Davis, and with co-host Maja in tow. It's funny, you know, I'm mostly a writer. A lot of my stuff can be found online at www.technosis.com, and writing is generally a pretty solitary act. You know, you crawl into your little head and you make some words happen and you fold them up on a paper airplane, metaphorically or not, and throw them out the window and maybe some people respond. But when I first got online a long time ago in the early 1990s, I discovered this other kind of writing. I went on to what was known then as a MUD, a multiple user dimension or dungeon, which was kind of like, you know, EverQuest or World of Warcraft, except it was all writing. People described the places they were. They described what they looked like. They wrote the descriptions of their actions. They wrote their dialogue with one another. And so what grew out of that was this amazing, interactive, real-time, collaborative writing project that felt very much like you were actually living and moving through this half-imagined space where you'd have conversations about politics, and then you'd play games, and then you would change your description like you were changing your clothes at a costume party. And it really gave me a sense that stayed with me that one of the things that's happening with our exploding and expanding digital universe is the opportunities for kinds of collaboration that go beyond even the sense of that term, which sounds like, you know, people getting together and making a barn or something. That what we're getting towards is something where our minds, our spirits, our impulses, our sense of ourselves is being challenged, transformed, opened up as we weave ourselves together. And a lot of the sort of, you know, hottest thing in the last few years online, all the social networks and Twitter and such are signs of some other, even deeper ways in which technology and media are changing our sense of selves and changing the way in which we connect with other people. I'm curious, Maja, have you spent much time in any social networks? Are you on Facebook? Do you Twitter?
Guilty as charged. I don't Twitter, but I do Facebook and MySpace and all that stuff. But I, like you, way back, like when the internet just started, I would do a lot of those kind of, you know, typing and chat kind of things. And even way back in the day, like I was a big fan of games like Zork, which just, you know, shows that I'm a dork. But it was like this all text, you know, descriptions of wizard stuff and games like that. And I was always a very big fan of those. And so I would participate. And I always loved how it was just this way that you could interact with something just by typing and using words. But it did go, even early on, I noticed that it goes to a much deeper level than I think most people realize, where they're just kind of on the surface typing in this thing and, like, talking to other people. But it does it, like, you're infiltrating other people's psyche on this interface. Like, I just love that concept of an interface where you can have this weird kind of connection to lots and lots of people all at once just by typing stuff. So, yeah, I've been very fascinated by that as well.
Yeah, I really like the way you also point out how I think a lot when we're interacting with new media, there's sort of there's many levels. There's a technological level as well, but there's two main levels we experience it at. On one level, it's just an extension of our ordinary lives. It's just we're just sort of doing another version of what we've already learned how to do. I might use chat, but, you know, 10 years ago I was on the phone, and 10 years before that I was writing a letter, and it doesn't feel like it's a great disturbance or a great transformative move necessarily because I'm staying on the surface. I'm just using it to get things done, to communicate
totally
with people. But then right below it, there's a whole other set of things that are happening that are much more significant, and that sometimes it's hard to get there. And one of the reasons that I'm so happy to have our guest on today, Mark Pesce, who's calling in from Australia, is that from the very beginnings of when I got interested in the internet and the possibilities for culture and consciousness, way back in the early 90s, at that same time, I first encountered Mark, and he's always been someone, whatever he's interested in, virtual reality, kids games, networks, social networks, Twitter. He always has a fascinating big picture view that lets me tap into that deeper level that goes on beneath our surface experience of these technologies. So, with no further ado, Mark, I welcome to Expanding Mind, and thanks for taking the time. You had to get up early for this, didn't you?
I did. I had to get up at 5:30 Sydney time to have a chat with you this morning.
Well, I really appreciate it. Just before we go dive into it, though, tell me a little bit about what your life is like there in Sydney. Like, what brought you to Sydney? It does involve technology and media, I take it.
It does. Back in 2003, I was over here for a conference and really fell in love with Sydney. And with Australia in general, and those of your listeners who have been to Australia probably do understand it's very easy to fall in love with Australia. And I was offered an opportunity to set up a program at the National Film School. Australia has a national film school, so it's sponsored, paid for by the federal government, called the Australian Film, Television, and Radio School. And they asked me to come and spend some time with them to figure out how to bring their filmmaking practice into the 21st century, because really their filmmaking practice had been about, well, let's go make a movie, and they'll have a piece of celluloid at the end, and that would be shown in a theater. But that's not, even by 2003, how people were watching movies. They were watching movies in their home on DVD, or perhaps even downloading them over the network. And so I helped ease them across that transition and what that transition would mean about how they would think about the production of a film or the production of a TV show. And after I explained the transition they were going to need to go through, they said, well, could you stay and actually help us cross that transition? And I spent 2.5 years working with them doing that. And since then, I've been a bit of a free agent.
That's great. I'm kind of curious, when you meet somebody who's like, well-established and let's call it old media, and it's kind of funny to think of cinema itself as sort of old media in some ways, and, they're very thoroughly aware of their world, but for some reason they've stayed away from this 21st century thing. What's the main thing, on the big picture you try to get across to people about how creativity and communication is changing now?
Well, I mean, I think about the lure that you use is that you tell them that this will give them a bigger audience, all right? So in other words, you put it into terms that they can easily understand, because both film and television at some level, at least in the sense of popular film and popular television, we're not talking about art film or art television, but in the sense of popular film and television, are always about reaching the broadest possible audience. And so if you frame it for them by saying, look, this is where the audience is, that the audience that you knew has moved. And if you put it in terms like that and then say, okay, the audience has moved and here is how you can follow the audience, then it becomes something that's very easy for them to accept.
And then what is it about that, but on a, like on a bigger level, like it's not just about different forms of distribution. Isn't it almost like a different sense of like how you relate between a creator and the audience, like who the audience actually is? Isn't it? Are we shifting outside of the mass media mind that dominated so much of 20th century culture?
Well, at one level, and this is the part that I don't always tell the filmmakers, because this is now the part that causes them to get shingles, which is that what we've now got is a system where, and this has been true for, we could probably say since the early years of the last decade, so 2002, 2003, it's been fairly possible for an individual to create some piece of work, whether that's a film or video or an album or whatever it is, and self-distribute that work. So be able to take that work and get it out there themselves. Now, the big Rubicon that was crossed in all of this was the development of a technology known as BitTorrent. BitTorrent basically made it incredibly effective and very easy to take a very big file, such as a movie file or an audio file, and send it out to as many people as you'd want. And it would be so efficient that the more people who wanted to get to this file, the more efficient it would be for every successive person. So if you are only getting it out to 20 people, it's only modestly efficient. But if you're getting it out to 20,000 people, it's very efficient, very inexpensive. And all of a sudden, the institutions that were charged with distributing works, so that might be a film studio, that might be a television channel, that might be a recording company, all of these institutions lost their inherent advantage in that they had the access to the marketplace of the audience. And so sort of overnight, that completely changed. And so now you had an audience that was just as capable of producing and sharing its own works as it was capable of receiving these works and listening to them. So that changed the ground immediately. And now we're into this era where now everyone is freely sharing their own works. I mean, we all know that people are sharing things on YouTube all the time. People are sharing things on file sharing networks all the time, so on and so on and so on. And that has meant that there is now vast competition for any of these highly regular, highly normal media channels, whether it's a television network or a film studio or whatever it might be. And so all of these normal media channels are now in a completely different environment where they have to confront the fact that the audience is just as creative as they are and in many circumstances is outperforming them creatively.
We'll talk about that a little bit more. I mean, how do you see that? Do you see there being a real shift towards more and more people actually entertaining themselves, fulfilling the need for meaning in their lives and distraction with producing stuff? And then getting it from other people who are producing it, essentially for free, or at least outside of the traditional channels. Is that just a sort of small kind of internet obsessed group, or is it increasingly the quote unquote man on the street finding that this is just as fun and in some ways a lot more fun?
Well, what we can do is I actually did an analysis and I took a look at the behavior that I was doing and realized that it was something else that everyone else was doing as well. And it's the behavior that I call the three F's behavior. You know, we find something, and we find media everywhere these days. We live in an environment where we're saturated with media, where media is hyperabundant, and we're constantly finding something. And as soon as we find something and have this moment of enjoyment associated with it, the companion to that moment of enjoyment is this idea of a filtering, that we immediately realize in that moment who else would benefit, who else would enjoy, who else would learn from that piece of media, whatever it might be. And then in the next moment, we forward that media along. And if you think of what happens with email, you think of what happens with YouTube, you think of what happens with any of the sites that are around sharing media, those sites are specific and explicitly set up to help you find, to help you filter, and to help you forward media along them. All of us are doing this all the time. Take a look at your email inbox. How much of your email inbox is links or pictures or video? All right? And so we're all doing this. And so we've all become, basically, you can almost think of it as network programmers, like in the television network. Network programmers constantly sharing things with our close friends or with our close associates. And we're all doing this. We don't really think too much about it, but we're all doing it.
It's kind of like curation, really, when you think about a curator, brings together different art pieces for a gallery show. It's like we create our own little clusters, and we have different audiences already. We are already kind of micro-dividing our email lists and our friend groups into different people who would like different kinds of material. But what's the deeper significance of that? I mean, okay, so there's a new way that people distribute or help other people navigate through and discover cool things in the media space. But it seems like it has even more long-term significance.
Well, the entire system of sort of arbitration about what is culture, about what is important, about what you come to know and how you come to know it, which had been formal over the last century, where you'd have a newspaper editor saying these are the articles that are going to the newspaper, or a newsreel editor going, saying, okay, these are the news of the day articles that are going to go into the newsreel you'll see in the cinema, or the television broadcast editor, here's the articles that are going to show up in your news on the evening news. All of these kinds of systems of filtering and regulation have been completely short-circuited. So now what's coming through is basically what your friends and what your associates think are important for you. So we've turned that entire system on its head, where rather than one person or one organization telling you what's important, it is the sum total of your network, of your connections, coming at you from every direction now, helping to inform you what is important, what you should care about.
So the difference is mostly content then, like whereas before the content is dictated by like one source, like, you know, back in the day kind of the Catholic Church would dictate what information everybody gets, what we experience with this kind of, you know, phenomenon that you're talking about, is that the content starts coming from everybody and it becomes a truly shared experience instead of just a one-way dialogue between one source of information. It's everybody's sources of information interacting with everybody else's sources of information, which I think is, like, on a just purely metaphoric level, I mean, that's where we're starting to get the interface happening, is because it's everybody sharing with everybody else instead of a dictatorship.
And you've put your finger exactly on it, that this is all being driven by sharing, that sharing is the engine that is driving culture along in the 21st century. And, of course, it's showing up in a lot of different domains. This is this entire area that we've been talking about I call the sharing of culture, because really what we're doing is we're taking the artifacts of culture and then dropping them into the pipes that we have, connecting all of us together so well and passing them along. And just that sharing of culture has basically forced us to revisit all of the assumptions about how culture operates, about how coming to knowledge operates, about how building a consensus operates. Every one of these things has changed because the way that that happens has now changed.
So what are other ways you see this sharing ethic expanding beyond the way in which we consume culture and then we immediately have this impulse to spread it, to let our friend groups know about it. But even further, how do you see the sign of this kind of shift towards a more sharing culture?
Well, the next level that you get to, after you've sort of got a sharing of culture, and the interesting thing about when you get to the sharing of culture, the thing that happens right away is that networks both build. They appear because there's this sharing going on. But once that sharing's in place, what happens is the sharing reinforces the vitality of that network. Every time you share something with another person, you are basically reinforcing that relationship with that other person. So all of the sharing that's going on all the time is building and reinforcing these networks. Now, once those networks are in place, it becomes a matter of, okay, what are you going to use them for? Are you going to use them for the sort of casual sharing that you might do day in or day out? Or are you going to put it to work towards some end? So you have projects such as, and really the archetypal project in this space is Wikipedia, where people have decided to share information in a specific format that is the encyclopedia article around every possible subject on Earth. And basically a relatively small number of individuals, there's a few thousand individuals who sit at the core of Wikipedia, have been arbitrating and sharing the workload for that project and have been doing so for now 9 years, and have managed to put together an encyclopedia that then everyone else can use based on their efforts as a network to share information around that.
Well, let's stay with Wikipedia just a little bit, just because it's an example that a lot of people are familiar with, and it also became for a while a sort of football to argue over, in the sense that defenders of the old order, if you will, who are saying, yes, all this is fine and well, this kind of collaborative thinking and collaborative arbitration is very effective for certain kinds of information, but for other things it's really not very good. And in fact, if we are holding up Wikipedia as a very good example of this kind of sharing and the productivity associated with it, well, actually, it's riddled with errors, there's all sorts of politics, there's a lot of problems with the system, et cetera, et cetera. I know that you've been paying attention to Wikipedia, you know, since it's got legs, and I'm curious how you see it, how is that transformed? Is that a viable argument? Do you think that Wikipedia has proven the powers of this approach. How would you assess it now?
I would think that most of the critiques that have made of Wikipedia are at least in some sense correct. I think the one critique of Wikipedia that bears the least weight is this idea that Wikipedia is inaccurate, because all sources of information are to some degree inaccurate. And, you know, Nature, the esteemed British periodical, put this to rest 3 years ago when they did a side-by-side analysis of Encyclopedia Britannica and Wikipedia, and found that on average Wikipedia was almost as accurate as Encyclopedia Britannica was. And that was, I think, a watershed moment, because it really showed people that Wikipedia, this thing that was created by the masses for the masses, was a valuable and vital source. I think the thing that we need to focus on here, beyond all of the critiques, and there are reasons why the critiques are valuable, and we can talk about that in a minute, is that Wikipedia represents, and it's at its essence, the first new kind of knowledge formation that we've seen in at least several hundred years, that this is a way for individuals to pool their expertise around one particular domain of interest. And the more that individuals do that, if they have different domains of interest, well, the broader that domain becomes, until with Wikipedia, that domain becomes very, very broad indeed. And this is a new way for us to be able to collect and use our knowledge, and it's a way that is replicable. So it doesn't have to just be Wikipedia. Now, when you talk about Wikipedia in the context of the politics of Wikipedia, one of the things that's been really interesting to watch over the last 3 years is that as Wikipedia has grown larger and larger and larger, it's actually been become harder and harder and harder to get a new article into Wikipedia. You get more and more pushback from the Wikipedians, these few thousand individuals who more or less manage the process of Wikipedia. They have higher and higher standards that they want to hold everyone to what constitutes a worthwhile article. Let me give you a good example for this. So the big movie this year at Christmas is James Cameron's Avatar. And one of the features of that film is a language that the natives of Pandora speak called Na'vi. The natives are the Na'vi, their language is called Na'vi. And this language is actually a conlang, or a constructed language, because James Cameron got a linguist from USC out to build an actual real language. It's an artificial language, but it's just as grammatically perfect as any human-spoken language, and it's in that sense similar to Klingon from Star Trek, which is also a conlang, it's a full language. And people watched the movie and were enthralled by this language, and the person who wrote the language actually wrote an article for a blog called The Language Log. And what he wrote about the structure of the language was immediately replicated in a Wikipedia article about that. And the Wikipedia article, if you go to it, the Na'vi, it just shows you the language and the construction of the language and how the language works. Now, that article was almost immediately tagged for deletion, because the folks who run Wikipedia get very nervous when articles about things that come out of fiction, in other words, metafictional topics, pop up in Wikipedia, because it's an open question for them whether Wikipedia is the right place for this, or whether this doesn't belong somewhere else, some other wiki, not a Wikipedia, because they're uncomfortable with this idea of whether it constitutes factual information. So we're now at the point with Wikipedia about having an argument about what constitutes fact. Is this factual enough? Is this real enough? Or is this just something that's sort of metafictional and belongs in its own metafictional blog talking about that metafictional universe?
Well, then it almost becomes like how many levels of reality they want to represent on Wikipedia, right? I mean, first of all, it's in a virtual reality place because it's on the computer and it's Wikipedia. And it's just kind of funny because then they're like, well, do we want to put only technically like real things, or real things that people have written about that were not true, or real things that are in a movie that somebody wrote? And then, like, I mean, I don't know how they're going to figure that out, because, I mean, then you just have to get way mystical and find out what reality is, really.
Right, and you know, at some level, I guess what they're saying is we need to draw the line somewhere. Now, I personally think that you need to draw the line very, very broadly, but they obviously don't feel that way. And there's another issue, which is biographies of living persons. who they have guidelines for this, but who determines who a notable person is? How can you determine whether you're a person of note and worthwhile, worthy of having a biography in Wikipedia while you're still alive? And so does that determine by how many hits get returned when someone Googles your name? Is it determined by some newspaper articles or television appearances or so on and so on and so forth? So all of these guidelines that sort of separate the inside of Wikipedia from the outside of Wikipedia are becoming highly contested areas right now. And they're essentially the front line of the advancing edge of this culture of sharing knowledge. You know, Wikipedia is getting to most of these places first.
Yeah, it's interesting how you're saying that the contested areas themselves are such are have such broad resonance for many different discussions and domains. I mean, one of them being the nature of whatever celebrity or worthwhileness, or whether you know, once you've let go of all of these conventional ways of understanding how people are valuable or what makes people valuable, then suddenly is it just a pure numerical thing? Does it involve some kind of argument or education? And in a way, that's what's happening with all of the sort of micro celebrity that are these information networks can produce, where you have somebody who just starts, you know, blogging in a certain way, or, you know, a character on Twitter who just takes off and suddenly they have a million followers, even though they're just like a musician in Portland and they just otherwise are one of a thousand people who just kind of, you know, muddle along. And it's a really interesting thing. I mean, it really shows some of how deep these challenges go in terms of what's valuable and what counts.
I know, like, is Joey Buttafuoco on there or what?
Well, we've been talking about sharing, Mark, and I want you to talk a little bit about your own project. Share This Course is the website associated with it, but you're trying to do something really interesting with this sharing culture and direct it in an experimental way. Can you talk about that?
Sure. Well, let me just sort of finish off the argument about what Wikipedia means, because that will lead into it really nicely.
Great.
So my observation from Wikipedia is that you can come to Wikipedia in a state of near ignorance. You can come not knowing a lot about something, and you can leave Wikipedia knowing a lot. You wouldn't know everything about something, but you'll know much more about something. So you can do that in any particular domain. And if you do that and then have to make a decision, if you'd had to make that decision based on your ignorance, it's very possible you could make the wrong decision. If you make a decision based on some information that you've gotten from Wikipedia, the chances are then improved that you will make a better decision around that particular domain, which means that Wikipedia then acts as an engine which allows you to improve your ability to make a decision. It allows you to improve your effectiveness as a person when it comes to making decisions. And Wikipedia isn't just doing that for you, it's doing that for everyone who's interacting with Wikipedia, which means that Wikipedia is now doing that potentially for tens or hundreds of millions of people all around the world. So we've now created, by sharing, we've now created this cultural object which now has this quality of its of an ability to improve our ability to make decisions. All right? So we've gone from being able to connect people together so that they can share, to the point where they can now share knowledge, to the point where that shared knowledge can improve their effectiveness as people. So that's a 1, 2, 3 step. And that basic process is the idea that I want to illustrate in a book, and I'm calling the book Share This Book because I see sharing as the engine that underlies all of this. And so in however many pages as it takes, I'm going to sort of outline this process. Now, when I sat down last year and said, okay, this is the book, I understand where I want to go with the book, I also realized that in order for my book to be valid, I was going to actually have to put the ideas in the book to work in the creation of the book. In other words, I wasn't just going to sit down in my garret and write out page after page, and I've done this for all of the other books that I've written. That's not the process that I wanted to do. What I wanted to do was actually to create the process that I was describing as a mechanism for creating the product. So rather than just sitting down in my garret, connecting together with other human beings in a community, getting us together than when we've connected to share knowledge. And then from sharing knowledge, using that shared knowledge to be more effective at the production of creating the book. So Share This Book as a book is now being created through a website called Share This Course, which was done basically because I hijacked a course that I was being offered to teach through Maybe Logic Academy to provide the shock troops, the students, to come in and work on the book with me. So the idea now is that we have a blog, we have a wiki, we have tools, we have Google Wave, we have all sorts of tools now, and we're now settling down to the task of actually thinking through each of the topics as they're coming up. And essentially my role is, I guess, sort of ringmaster, probably the closest term, but also the person who's trying to sort of drop ideas in. People are talking through ideas, but I'm constantly dropping through ideas that I've been thinking and bringing them in and using them then as starting points. So we're just now, we've spent the time together to be able to build the community up. Now that we think we have some relationships and we think that we know each other and there's some level of trust that's been built about that, now we can actually use those relationships to be productive in the process. So now we're at the point where we're starting to share not just culture and objects and things that allow us to know each other, but now we're starting to share knowledge.
Wow. So I'm really curious about this. Such a fascinating story. Yeah, at the same time, I'm trying to figure out like how it works, because it's so challenging as a writer to like the way I'm used to organizing things. At this point, are you even really thinking about what as a book this might look like, or are you just more opening to this process, to being self-aware about how this sharing and this knowledge sharing works, with a general goal that at some point it will, you know, take the form of a physical book, I'm sure, along with other kinds of media. Or are you really focused on like thinking, well, how is this going to manifest itself as, you know, this very old kind of media that is a book?
Well, it's interesting because, in fact, the three questions that I threw out, sort of the three bombs that I threw out when we very first got together, within the very first week of us getting together, the three big questions I asked were, what is a book, what is publishing, and what is an author? Because you used to be able to give very straightforward answers to each of those questions. And the answer to each of those questions has now gotten really kind of muddy. Okay, yeah, we kind of know what a book is if we go into a bookstore and buy a book, but that's not the only place the books live anymore. What is an author? Well, if you're the lone author toiling in your garret, then you know what an author is. But if you look at Wikipedia at the other end of the scale, then all the idea of authorship is now rather more rich. It's rather more complex. And what is publishing? Does publishing even matter anymore? I mean, 2010 is going to see now the rise of the e-book and this complete change in what publishing is and what books mean. And so we're sort of in the midst of that as well. And so I throw those questions out there right away because I wanted us to have very rich opinions around this, where we weren't saying we're going for one thing or another or another. Now, at some level, I do think that the text has to be linear, that it has to be able to go from point A to point B, and that it has to be a place that people can take the journey with you. But that doesn't mean that that text, even if it's going from point A to point B, can't be rich with filigrees on the side that come out and tell other stories, because we live in an age of hypertext, and that's one of the advantages. It's one of the drawbacks of one of the advantages and one of the sort of winning arguments for hypertext. I guess it's a drawback as well, because it all, you know, allows you to become too diffuse and allows the point to sort of fritter away. But that's the sort of edge that you have to balance with what the text is. And with the author, well, it's not just me working on it, but rather a crew of people working on it. Well, what does that mean for each of our roles? How do we balance our roles? How do we make sense of those roles? And how do we meaningfully participate? Well, I don't know that we have perfect answers. And so Share This Book and Share This Course are, in a sense, as much about documenting the process as they are about creating a product. Because what I want us to do is to pass through a learning process that is then replicable, the same way that the ideas behind Wikipedia are replicable to another blog that's maybe about Star Wars or another blog that's maybe about medicine. Hopefully, Share This Book will present a creative process that is replicable to other kinds of creative collaborative projects.
Great. I think we're going to take a short break here on Expanding Mind, just to hear a couple of promos for other shows on the network, and we'll be back with Mark Pesce in a minute or two.
You are listening to the Progressive Radio Network, your number one source for progressive commentary.
Hello, everybody. This is Richard Martin of Richard Martin's Wake Up Call. I'm on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com twice a week on Mondays and Fridays at 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time to guide you and hold your hand through the worst economic catastrophe of all time. I predicted this right here on PRN back in 2005, along with the housing meltdown. Listen in and hear how this calamity is about to get much worse, and hear me suggest ways in which you can sidestep a large part of the horror. Call in and have your questions answered in real time. Let's see this thing through together. ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com hosts my show Mondays and Fridays at 10 a.m. EST right here.
This is Peter Roth, the host of Energy Stew on Thursday nights at 7:30. The show is about life's patterns, how they influence our lives, and how our own patterns influence life around us. It's about knowing ourselves better and understanding the mechanics of our life journey. We have wonderful guests who have made great contributions to the knowledge of ourselves. Tune in on Thursday evenings at 7:30 for Energy Stew on Progressive Radio Network.
Don't miss out on Dr. Michio Kaku's weekly show, Explorations. Dr. Kaku is the only scientist with his own nationally syndicated radio show. Explorations is the program that explains complex physics with an accessible approach. So take an exploration with Dr. Michio Kaku, Tuesdays at 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, to discuss topics ranging from space exploration to stem cell research.
This is PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind. We're here talking with our guest, Mark Pesce, and we're talking about kind of the idea of a hive mind collective group creating things and making things. And it was funny, Mark, you know, when you were talking about how it would end up like a book, in my mind, it kind of brought House of Leaves, which was a book called Mark Danielewski. I don't know if you've ever seen that one, but just how it's total hypertext and like all this stuff kind of stuck in everywhere, but the stories kind of lead from one into the other. And even though that was only written by one person, I kind of envision your project maybe being like kind of like that, like just going in and out of things. But it's like Eric, I also write by myself, very much in isolation, so it's fascinating to me this project that you've been able to do, and I'm very interested in the success of it. But what I wanted to ask is if you guys have experienced any kind of strange telepathy while you're working in the group, like with each other doing writing, like has there been any strange like synchronicities with each other where you guys feel like your minds do get kind of linked up?
Yeah, I think it is interesting. Most of what we've been doing so far has been around getting to know one another. And that was a very deliberate part of social engineering from my own point of view, that I realized that this had to be the ground level, because if people were going to collaborate, if they were going to share and collaborate with knowledge, that actually takes an enormous amount of trust, otherwise it turns into an ego game. And so in order to sort of do the best to short circuit the ego games that would play with, no, I'm right, no, I'm right, no, I'm right, with that sort of thing, we've been basically just spending time getting to know one another, and I've been trying to encourage that as much as possible with exercises. One of the things that we did, I recently went on holidays all around Australia and couldn't sort of be with the blog and with the community every single day. So I gave them an assignment. I was like, look, for the next 10 days, I want you to share something, some sort of item of digital media that tells us something about you. And I was basically sending photographs that I was taking during my little road trip, posting them up every day, but other people were pulling up all of this amazing stuff that was meaningful to them, a lecture that they'd heard, a paper that they'd read, whatever it might be, over and over, a video that they'd watched. And so the goal there was to get people, I don't know if it's onto the same wavelength, but to understand at a distance, because most of these people have never met and will never meet, get them to understand at a distance who their peers are, who they are and what they mean to each other. Maybe now that we're starting to work more formally and starting to actually work on the text, we'll start to see these instances of telepathy pop out. If so, what we've got is we've got a place or places to capture those moments, because it could show up on the blog, it could show up on the wiki, it could show up on Google Wave, that people will be on the same wavelength at the same time, and it will be hopefully apparent.
Well, it's interesting just to think about the whole idea of the hive mind, the idea of the productivity and the actual consciousness of a group of people that emerges from a group of people or a group of insects. That's where the metaphor comes from. But it's interesting to think about what would it actually feel like. Maybe the hive mind is fully in effect, but we just don't necessarily see it or feel it or notice it as individuals unless we're looking for certain kinds of patterns. At the same time, there's clearly a sense with some network media, I think Twitter is a good example, where the deeper you go into it, something odd starts to happen. It's not necessarily telepathic or anything that you need to invoke unusual forces for, but nonetheless has a strange kind of multiplicity to it. And I know that you've thought a lot about this and that you're also like a big Twitter person. Talk about some of the other ways that the hive mind might be manifesting itself or what it feels like to be weaving yourself into a hive mind.
It really is interesting. I had this exact conversation 3 days ago with one of my good friends whom I met on Twitter. And Twitter is the first pass. I think most of the people who are heavy users of Twitter would say that it's the first pass at something like a hive mind. And essentially, the interesting thing is that I think, and it's because humans already have very big minds on their own, that Twitter is, at its best, it's this lovely little sort of buzzing in the background, and you can choose to pay attention to the buzzing if you want, or you can choose to ignore the buzzing if you want. But here is the kicker. There's a price to be paid either way. If you choose to pay attention to the buzzing, that can suck up all of your attention and all of your time. It can basically make it so that you can fully invest yourself in a hive mind. Now, the more that you do that, in some sense, the less interesting that you become to that hive mind, because the less new things, the less novelty you're dumping into that hive mind, because you're not actually out there living. So you go the other direction and say, okay, well, I'm not going to pay too much attention to that hive mind. Well, again, you sort of become more disconnected with the less attention that you pay to it. It becomes less relevant. You become less relevant to it. And so you have to sort of find that medium point, that balance point. And that balance point for any individual on Twitter varies from minute to minute. It varies from task to task. It varies from day to day. It varies from time of life to time of life. So there are times when Twitter is really important, and there are times when it's not important at all. But for instance, if I'm in a strange city, which happened as I was popping around Australia on my little road trip, and I wanted to know a great place to go have dinner, for example, in Canberra, the nation's capital, all I did was put that out and immediately got back a list of lovely places to have a cheap and wonderful dinner. And true enough, I went out and did that. So it was like having access to the collective wisdom of a huge number of people, and it's possible to put that wisdom to work. But again, like anything that powerful, there is a price to pay, and there's a price not to pay.
Yeah, it's also, like you say, it's a matter of investment. I mean, for example, you were able to do that because you have invested already so much time and energy in Twitter that you have like quite a large network so that people are out there to ping, whereas if I was in Canberra and I sent that out, except for you, I might not, you know, no one might be caring because I haven't put that much into it. But one of the things that this brings up for me about the whole sharing culture, and I speak in this sense very personally because, you know, I started off after college as a freelance writer, and I actually made a decent living for quite a while, and I still hold on, but it's a tough world out there to make content pay. And one of the things that this raises is this issue of like what the value that you are actually, the quote-unquote take-home value of your activity in communication is about. If I spend more and more time on Twitter, I get more and more sort of social capital and I get more information, and I get a whole set of individuals that I may be, you know, discovering, but that doesn't necessarily mean that much outside of that network. And I think a lot of the things that draw us in, you know, multiplayer computer games are also like this. I mean, I could spend, you know, 8 hours a day in World of Warcraft, and within that world, it would open up, it would grow rich, it would grow detailed and nuanced. I would learn about politics, technology. I would meet people from around the world. All these relationships would form, and yet outside of that world, it's almost meaningless. It might even suck my energy away from something else. So it's a very strange experience to be navigating these different worlds with that question: where does this actually pay out? Is it in the experience? Is it in the transferability of information? It's a tough one.
I mean, I think this is where we get to the core of making that transition between the sharing of culture to the sharing of knowledge, because the same thing happens inside of these social networks. Now, both because of the kinds of work that I've done in Australia, but also I think sort of just because of my predilections, I have balanced my networks, particularly in Twitter, toward people who study education and toward people who also study social networks. And so I have, in essence, access to enormous reservoirs of information across those domains, which then help me in my regular work for which I get paid money. So it's not just something that is then something I'm just playing in or something that I'm just investing in that doesn't have a received value or a value that I can earn from it. Even though I didn't really set out to earn from it, what I did was set out to improve my knowledge capability. I set out to improve my effectiveness as a knowledge worker. And you can tune, and you should tune, your social networks to help you become more adept as a knowledge worker, because I guess absolutely, just as you said, the alternative is that they'll simply fritter all of your energy away.
How do you
and
manage
your ideas, too? I mean, like Eric said, it becomes, when you do have, like, unique ideas and these kind of intellectual properties, as you might want to call them, that is the big dilemma about sharing, right? I mean, that's what happens in every relationship. You have to kind of decide how much you want to share with people, because people are going to rip you off, kind of. And I think there's a lot of that has happened on the internet, with people just appropriate information without, you know, properly citing sources or giving people credit. And I think that is one thing that you just kind of have to abandon when you go on and share things with people, is you just kind of can't expect any return, and you just share it for the sheer purpose of sharing and giving over this information without any kind of real thought to intellectual properties. But that's kind of difficult to do sometimes, I think.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is a key point, because one of the goals of Share This Book is that the book is going to be shared. It's going to be available freely. But my sense for this, and I think this is the sense for everyone who's working on a project, is that the more that book is shared, and this is one of the major theses of the book, is that the more something is shared, the more valuable it becomes, because it sort of infiltrates itself into the common mind. So that if Share This Book is a success, however we want to define it, in other words, if people read it and it becomes influential, or if people participate in it and it becomes influential in that way, then I become more valuable as a human being. People are going to want to be able to talk to me about my ideas and how my ideas can be applied to their own domains. And I have a consulting business, and that's how I make most of my money. And so the fact that I have made something that people can read and enjoy and learn from makes me more valuable to them. And if my social networks have been tuned correctly, then getting to the people who need that becomes an easier process.
Yeah, I guess part of the question I have is whether that's transferable to other kinds of work that people do, whether other kinds of writing, other kinds of worlds that people want to create. And I think that's an issue that a lot of people are dealing with. Even people who are really using the new media to create culture, there's also a certain way that the rules and the shape and the flavor of the cultural objects that one creates are changing in relationship to this this sort of networked hive mind of reference and sharing. I mean, I think that, you know, we didn't really talk earlier about the value factor in terms of judging these, you know, creative things, but it seems to me that, and maybe this is a simplistic reaction, but that the forward this link, here's this thing that you'll like, mindset tends to emphasize things that are very quick, very funny, or like, you know, where they deliver their message or their juiciness or their point of view in a very condensed kind of way. I mean, obviously people forward long articles, long, thoughtful, you know, entire websites full of treasures, et cetera, et cetera. It's not a general rule. But it does seem to me that the content of communication and even the sort of flavor of it is changing quite dramatically in order to fit itself or in order to be more viral or to be more infectious, to get more numbers, as it were, even if it's not setting out with a purely quantitative goal in mind. And I do sometimes wonder and have troubling thoughts about the long-term consequences of that. How do you deal with that question, which obviously comes up? I mean, it's something that a lot of people talk about.
Yeah, I think this is a really interesting point, and in some sense I've adapted myself to it. One of the statements that I, or one of the promises I made to myself, and actually posted about it on the Share This Course blog, which is at sharethiscourse.org, by the way, if you folks want to go over and have a look at it or participate and join in, is that I realized that there was a rule that we call the TLDR rule. TLDR is shorthand for too long didn't read, and essentially means that any blog post that's longer than 300 words is probably going to be glossed over by someone. 300 words is just about the right limit where someone is willing to invest themselves without feeling that they really have to invest themselves. Oh, okay, this is going to be interesting enough. It's three or four paragraphs, bam, 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 good. I can now move on. It's the tidbit size. It's the bite-sized information thing. And so almost all, maybe even all of the postings that I've made on the Share This Course blog have been that length. Now, that's forced me into a kind of brevity I've never had to use before, which is actually really useful as an exercise. And it's something I've also been trying to get everyone else who's writing on the blog, because one of the things that I did right off was say, look, it's not just me writing on this blog. I'm giving all of you authorship privileges. Please write your own articles on this blog so that we're having a multi-way conversation going. I've been trying to bring them all into this understanding as well, because we want to make sure that everything is digestible and that if you can't get it all out in 300 words, then maybe you need to break it up and do that. Now, that's going to hit a wall when we start actually talking about long form. But there's a difference there. We actually have different expectations for long form work versus short form work. A blog is a great place for short form work. A book, and I'm using that word in quotes, is a place to tell longer stories. And so the reader is willing to give you permission to tell a longer story. And if they aren't, well, that's the price of entry. If you aren't willing to do that, then you're right. You aren't ready to read the book.
How do you think this is changing our politics? Do you see this as having tremendous influence eventually in the way that things get discussed in the physical world of power plants and standing armies and trade negotiations and elected politicians?
Well, I mean, I think that one of the things that we're bringing to the table now is that we're bringing this enormous capacity to educate ourselves very quickly on any particular subject of interest. And so that then means that we don't have to, that the role of experts ends up changing I think both subtly but also fairly profoundly, that the expert isn't simply the person who knows it all. The expert is the person who can manage a community of people who know an awful lot, and that that may be then a political community. So that politics in the 21st century looks more like groups who have chosen to share knowledge to empower themselves going after a particular political goal. That's what it looks like. So it's not, you're not talking about mass politics where you're talking about tens of millions of people. You're talking about a few hundred to a few thousand people who have really dedicated themselves to going after a goal because they've decided to share their knowledge and share their culture and empower themselves toward the pursuit of that goal.
Can you think of examples of that that are not so specifically internet-related? I mean, you can. It's easier to see examples of that inside the network, but what else?
Well, the interesting thing is, and it's both true and weird at the same time, is that Al-Qaeda is the nascent form of this. That Al-Qaeda isn't an organization, it isn't a tribe, it's a network, all right? And it's a network of like-minded people. And what do they do across that network? They exchange information, and they improve their effectiveness as an organization by trying to trade their effectiveness, by trying to share information through that organization. And so this is what makes it extremely nebulous, extremely difficult, half a boogeyman and half a cause, all right? So you've got in Al-Qaeda, that's sort of the crossing over point between insurgencies as we've known them in the, say, 19th and 20th centuries and this new form of organization. And the reason that this new form of organization arose is because states, as we've known them, got very, very good at damping down any other kind of insurgency. So an insurgency arose that was so well tuned to the network era that the state finds it very hard to damp out.
Well, that's an interesting example. And also, it's about the way that those communication, the way that that culture gets spread, the sense of urgency, the sense of intensity, the sense of identity that come through these political messages. I mean, that's one of the things that I think is scary, and we can see it in our own culture in America with like the Tea Party stuff and this kind of like bubbling up rage that's focused in these very fuzzy ways that nonetheless ends up having a significant impact, where it's a lot about communicating affect, communicating feeling more than, you know, ideological positions. Even though there is an ideology working there, a lot of it is also just about tapping into certain very core feelings and using media and memes, if you will, to stir up a certain kind of emotional investment that then becomes a kind of identity. And it's like we're working on different levels of the human being, much beyond the level of discourse, of rational politics, of argumentation. There's a whole sort of psychological depth to the way that these network, at least these political kind of networks, can operate.
Absolutely, and the sharing of culture is really, then around the sharing of affect, as you've put it, I think, really beautifully, and I may actually steal that if you don't mind. But the sharing of affect. The sharing of affect has to be accompanied by the sharing of culture. You find shared things, shared values, whatever you want to call it, shared archetypes that people are holding in common, and they rally around that. And that can then become a focal point for the sharing of knowledge and the sharing of power. And that's, it's just that simple. And we're seeing this happen more and more now because the engines of sharing are becoming radically more efficient. It is so much easier for us to share things now in 2010 than it was in 2000, that it's bigger than night and day. It's completely before and after.
Well, that's great. Mark, I want to thank you for joining us here on Expanding Mind. Folks, again, the website for Share This Course, which will become Share This Book, is, as you might expect, sharethiscourse.org. And Mark is also a relentless Twitterer. I enjoy following him there and keeping up with my pal, even though he's so far away. So thanks again, Mark, and best of luck to you.
Thank you all both very much.
Thanks,
brother. Bye.